Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 616. I hope you guys are going to have a nice holiday season. I hope you have a wonderful, whatever it is that you're celebrating. If you're celebrating just the fact that you don't have to work, or if you do have to work.
That's the best thing to celebrate.
Is not having to work?
Yeah. Just not wearing pants, sitting in your house. It's the best.
You barely wear pants to come in here.
I started wearing pants a good long time ago, sir.
Yes, we've trained him and put pants on him. You're like the water skiing squirrel.
I thought that would get Jonah Ray's condescending looks to stop. I was wrong, but I like the pants.
It only increased their intensity. But I hope you guys have a wonderful holiday season. This episode is Joe Perry from Aerosmith, and he just released a 4-song EP, Joe Perry's Christmas, and also has his memoir, Rocks, My Life In and Out of Aerosmith. And so we literally just recorded Joe, and what did you say?
Okay, so I'm walking him to the parking lot, and they're like, oh, who are you guys interviewing next? I'm like, oh, we're going and interviewing Paul McCartney. And he's like, oh, fun fact, I just recorded with Paul McCartney. Yeah, it was me and Alice Cooper and Johnny Depp.
What?
And we're recording a Badfinger song that Paul McCartney wrote back in when Badfinger's first album was coming out, when they were banned on Apple Records, that he wrote because they needed a hit.
Oh my God.
And Paul had written and recorded all the parts, gave Badfinger the demo. They recorded it. It did become a hit because that's what Paul McCartney does.
Yeah.
And then he'd never touched it again. And then was like, you know what I need to do is get Alice Cooper, Joe Perry, and Johnny Depp to come and help me re-record it like 30 years later.
Oh my God. Well, see, I didn't want to bring up that McCartney was going to be the next guest, because you don't know what people's relationships are, and I'd also
It turns out real good.
But I also didn't want to be like, well, our next guest is Paul McCartney. You know, I didn't want to be.
Well,
that
I like
guy.
That the Paul one will be out after all or before all of these, so there's just going to be this weird run of everybody going, are we going to talk to Paul? How are we going to go?
I know.
Well, because I'm going to be like, guys, it went fine.
Because now I'll ask him about that. So basically,
oh, there we go.
These will be time shifted.
We got dirt.
Yeah, if you listen to them actually in order, then they're actually
the way they come out. It's like a William Burroughs thing, like we've just cut up and put the podcast in different order.
That's right. So you, the viewer, will have to decide what the real time stream is. It's Nerdist Podcast number 616 with Joe Perry.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How are you?
All right. How about you?
I'm good.
Yeah.
Are you winding down for the holidays, or is this a busier time of year for you?
It's I don't know. That's a multi-layered question. We're kind of as the book tour ended, we figured, you know, we're going to go to Florida, maybe even have Christmas there. Mm-hmm. You know, have all the kids fly down, and then the book came in at. On the charts pretty high, and which blew our minds, and so a whole bunch more opportunities to do more podcasts and things, so we ended up staying out here, and I was planning on doing some solo stuff, work on my solo stuff out here, and just to fill in the time, you know, between whatever. And I figured, well, why not do some Christmas songs? I mean, we haven't done. You know, I've always wanted to do some kind of Christmas record with the, you know, Aerosmith, and we just never. It was on one of those short lists, you know, like a blues record, cover a rock and roll record, do whatever, and it just never happened. So I just said, well, let's just shift gears and jump in the studio and see what comes out. And fortunately, because it's near the holidays, a lot of the local guys that we know that are great players, you know, like the horn players and stuff, were available, and we were able to fit in a few hours every day, and so we put this EP together, and actually it worked out for a couple of reasons. I mean, not only were we able to do the EP and hook it up with a charity to help bring music to the schools. I mean, mm-hmm. we're always trying to help out with that. But then they wanted to, somebody said, I think VH1 said, can you do a video with it, and so we ended up doing a video for it, and
so then it started to
build up again and build up again, and so now we got a bunch of stuff to do and to wind that up, and we had some business that showed up that we weren't expecting, so I ended up having to stay out here until I think about the 20th. Then we're going to split for Vermont.
Then you have a couple days off.
Then we'll have some days off. But, you know, come on. Is Christmas really off? You know what I mean? I mean, you're running around shopping that stuff.
It's not just like, a different kind of...
You can focus on that. And it's really... I think that like after Christmas is done and... the holidays are over, we'll be able to chill out. You know?
Well, because it's like you have to shift out of work into family work.
Right.
I mean, you do get that nice moment, like, oh, it's Christmas, now we're trading presents, and we're all...
Right.
But everything around that is like, I forgot that guy. Oh, I gotta do that. Oh, shit.
It's that, you know, and so... But, you know, I mean, like you said, it's a whole different shift, and it kind of like breaks you in for... relaxing, so it's, you know, and being in Vermont is great, and it's a whole different thing.
What does Aerosmith give each other for Christmas? Do you guys have we don't need anything else, no presents, or is it like, what do you give each other?
You know, usually it's birthdays is when we do presents, but for it's been a long time. I mean, when the kids were small and we would all get together, you know, we would have a party, you know, all the families would get together, and everybody would, you know, do presents and all that stuff. But since everybody's kind of split and, you know, gone their own way with their own lives, it's pretty much, you know, Merry Christmas, you know, Happy New Year or whatever. And but like when it really comes down to giving out presents, it's like if I see something really cool that I know Tom likes or would like, you know, I'll get it for his birthday or something like that. It's really loose, you know. So you know, that's about how we deal with it.
How long has it been now that you guys have been together?
We had our 40th. I think Toys in the Attic came out 40 years ago. So we've been together probably 42 or 43 years.
Jesus Christ.
And
how do you guys stay together? Like, to me, it's a wonder that any band ever stays together.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, like, it's hard enough to have a two-person relationship, but to have, like, a many-person relationship where everyone's got to have, you know, because ultimately I assume... you know, you all have to have similar goals and want to work to make a similar thing over time. And like, how does it sustain that long?
Thanks. Well, you know, it's. I guess it's because, you know, like when we first got together, I mean, we it wasn't like we were a bunch of high school friends that you know, all kind of got together and had a band as well and that kind of thing. I mean, we kind of, except for Tom and I, who were friends and met really when we were young. And I mean, we kind of picked the guys we wanted in the band for their musical skills and all that. And also we all loved rock and roll, and we all wanted to get on stage and play, you know. Nobody ever thought that, you know, it would be a career like this, like with, you know, in parentheses, you know what I mean, or whatever. I mean, it was like, let's see if we can get to the next week and pay the rent. Let's see if we can get through the next month and put food on the table, and maybe we'll get a record deal. We'll see, you know. But mainly it was just like keeping the calendar full with gigs, you know. And, hey, 1 year turned into the next, and then we managed to get some people around us to support us and help, and then we got a manager, and then we got a manager who helped us find some managers in New York, and just one thing after another, you know, day by day. And the main thing is we love to play live. We love to get on stage and play, and no matter what's gone on, except for the time I left the band for 4 or 5 years when we really needed to take a break. I needed to take a break and kind of settle a few things in my personal life, and just really let the band decompress. Aside from that, I mean, it was the feeling is the same, getting on stage and playing, you know, and hearing the audience cheer when we play some of those old songs and some of the new songs, and it's really been the thing that's held it together. It's been the fans and that original feeling of, like, you know, wow, we're getting on stage, and you know what? We might be able to do it better tomorrow. And that's the thing that hooks us in. So, you know, no matter what goes on, you know, maybe we can play the show better tomorrow. Maybe we can make a better record. And 42 years later, here we are. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, back then, man, it was not a career that you picked for longevity, that's for sure. You know, I mean, I think, what was it, 71 or 70? And Jimmy died, and Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin, and we would see bands come and go, bands that were, I mean, really good bands that had you know, everything. You know, songs on the radio, hit records and all that, and then they'd disappear, you know, for one reason or another, you know. It really wasn't something that you look down the road and go, well, we'll be doing this in 10 years, you know. I mean, nobody figured it was going to last like this.
How much of those bands kind of coming and going, how much of that do you think was just, oh, you know, general musical tastes have changed? And how much was it, oh, these people had a lot of personal issues? Like, have you ever, I'm sure you've met people before, you're like, wow, you're really talented. How come you're not, you know, like, further along? And then you realize they have, like, serious personal issues that got in the way, that prevented them from focusing and getting them to the next level. Like, did you notice any sort of a disparity or connection between those two things?
I think we've all seen it happen. I mean, probably one of the biggest examples of that would be Guns N' Roses. I mean, these guys were primed to be, you know, huge, and they could have been, you know, one of the biggest bands even today if they had kept things together. And obviously there were personal issues that they just couldn't deal with. I'm good friends with Slash, and I don't think that they could figure out what was going on with Axl, you know what I mean? And I mean, they went right from, I mean, we saw them, I mean, they opened for us that summer when they went from being like basically a club band, you know, kind of a so-called baby band. I mean, when they walked on stage, even then, you knew they had it and they could do it. You know what I mean? They'd go out there and they were great. They had a great first record, by the time the tour was over, they were like, they were steamrolling and they were crushing it. And you know, and then they had that year or two when they were, you know, filling every stadium in the world, literally. And then it just fell apart after that double album they did. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, Axl still goes out and plays, you know, with a band called Guns N' Roses, and he does great in wherever they play, you know, as far as drawing an audience, but it's not that band that right. everybody wants, you know what I mean? And I don't know if they could ever, at least talking to Slash, I don't know if they could get it back together. I really don't, you know. I'd like them to, because I think they're a great band. I think they're one in a million, but you know, it's just that personality thing. And this, I could go down the list, you know. But that's probably the one that you know everybody has seen. You know, all the fans of you know Guns N' Roses, you know, are scratching their heads, going, "Well, why can't they just go back in the studio and do another record and go back on the road? They don't even have to talk to each other." You know, I mean, there's a lot of bands that have stayed together, or they don't have anything to do with each other,
like the Police
when they're not
like a one tour.
Hey, you name them, man. Yeah. The list goes on. I mean, the Eagles, I don't think, from what I understand, they don't talk to each other, you know what I mean? When they're not on stage, or they deal with each other when they need to talk about some business or whatever, and then they're you know, to go their separate ways, but they managed to at least get on stage and play and do tours and whatever. But it's really a tough thing. I mean, it's way beyond just having a good song and being able to play good live and having your songs on the radio or back in the VH1 MTV days, you know, having a good video and all that. I mean, it takes a lot more than that. Because you're kind of growing, you know. I mean, your personal life. You go from being a teenager with no responsibility, no family, no kids to worry about, none of that. And then you get, you know, have a girlfriend, or you know, you get married, then the kids come along. So you kind of have to balance that personal life with the demands of what it takes to be in a rock band, which is really tough. And
yeah.
Again, if you, it's easy when you're a teenager and you don't mind all piling in a van or all on a tour bus and all that stuff. And it's like, you know, as you get older, it's really finding that balance of how you're going to deal with that. Because this guy wants to have girlfriends. This guy wants to hang around with the groupies. This guy wants to have a wife and kids, and he's going to bring them on the road, like me. And there's like, well, okay, well, I'm kind of like the odd man out then, because you know, what if my wife says something to this one's girlfriend or this one's wife, and it's like, and you know, it's like kind of like you have to talk those things out, and you know, or you know, just deal with it, you know. I mean, there are ways to. I bought a tour bus basically and just brought the family, the dog, the tutor, because we homeschooled the kids, and I just basically hung out with the band when we were at the shows, and then take off on the bus.
Oh, that's fun, though. That, yeah. It was great. It never felt too claustrophobic?
I love it. Are you kidding? I love touring on the bus. It's like you can come and go as you please. I've seen things that I would never get a chance to see if I had traveled with the band. You know, like Roswell, New Mexico. You know, I mean, I'm really into that kind of stuff, into the whole UFO and all that stuff I'm talking about. Joe Rogan and all that. I mean, I love all that stuff. And my wife and I are, I mean, and that was one of our first hobbies that we did when we got together was go out and find all these tapes that you could get, the VH1 tapes or VHS tapes, and of people, you know, people have taken of UFOs. And so, you know, what Roswell is one of those places that's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's not really on the way to anywhere.
No.
You know what I mean? It's not a destination, and it's not, you know, on the way to a destination. You kind of, I mean, it literally took us 8 hours out of our way.
Yeah, I did the same exact experience where I was driving across country. I was like, oh, let's just dip down to Roswell.
Right.
But I was kind of disappointed with Roswell because it was so many, like, maybe I needed to spend more time there. But what I saw was basically a bunch of storefronts that had just been converted into, like, quote-unquote museums with, like, weird rubber alien dolls.
Yeah.
And nothing really of substance that, yeah. Like, oh, I really wanted to see something that I hadn't seen on the internet, yeah. You know?
And they're all the official ones.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
what
every
I mean?
Single one. Yeah.
And I don't know. We went into one that seemed like, well, it had all the stuff on the wall that was like printed out, you know, like the newspapers and recordings of whatever, you know, radio recordings that they had saved. And then they had, you know, that was on one side, and then on the other side, you probably went in there, you know what I mean? Because there's three or four of them.
Right.
And then the other side is like, you know, all the coffee mugs with the aliens on them. And then the bits and pieces of whatever they have. And if you actually go to the place where it happened, it's just a piece of dried dirt. You know what I
right.
mean? It's like, you know, a couple of hundred square yards of you know, a little scrub brush where supposedly it happened. So it really is kind of a letdown. But, hey, if you're into that stuff, at least you can say you went to Roswell and you got the T-shirt. You know what I mean?
I know. I bought so many different Roswell T-shirts. I'm like, well, I need this one. I need this alien. I need this alien. I mean, it totally.
Yeah.
Like, it worked. I totally bought into it, even though I didn't actually. Have you seen anything? Have you seen anything?
I have never. You know, I mean, a couple of times we could have talked ourselves. We had a place up in New Hampshire, out on the lake, in Lake Sunapee, where the band met and everything. And we go out, and especially in I think it's August, there's usually a lot of meteor showers, you know, and we'll go out and sit out on the boat and watch, because the stars are amazing up there. And watch for meteors, and every once in a while you'll see something, and it's not moving the way it should, and you can convince yourself that, you know, hey, a UFO is basically an unidentified flying object. So there's a lot of things that qualify for that. It doesn't mean it's a spaceship.
Right.
It's just unidentified. You know what I mean? So you could, like I said, you could convince yourself that it's something, but I really haven't seen anything. I've talked to a lot of pilots, and they haven't seen anything. So no, I haven't. But I gotta believe that they're out there. You know, the extraterrestrial. They have another name for them now. You know, but no, I haven't seen anything like that or anything that would, you know, I could say, yep, that's it. I've been there. I've seen it.
What do you think Roswell was?
Hey, you know. It's tough, man, because there's enough noise and enough interviews about people that say that they've seen things, and there's that whole Area 51 that's really it really is a mystery. There's the plane that flies out of Vegas every day, packed with people. They go out to work, and they work where the government says there is nothing there, you know. But on the other hand, until I really see something, you know, I really can't say yes or no. But I'm certainly willing to I got an open mind about it.
That's right. You're skeptical but hopeful.
Yeah.
That's a good place
to
be.
You know, I mean, whether it's Bigfoot or, I mean, some of the, I mean, just think about the ocean, how big it is, how deep it is. And, I mean, there's got to be stuff in there that we haven't seen
yet. Oh, of course.
So, you know, so we're very open-minded about that stuff. But I really like we like to check out what the latest videos are and all that stuff. But who knows, you know.
So before we were talking about, you said, oh, it's kind of hard. These guys get in a band, and then all of a sudden these, like, you know, these interpersonal politics crop up. And it's sort of funny that rock music basically is, you know, you're young, you're a teenager, it's sort of, it's a rebellious form of art. And then all of a sudden, it, with any degree of success, comes a great degree of responsibility, which is kind of antithetical to the whole spirit of why you started in the, or why most people, I would imagine, start in the first place. Right. They're rebelling, they're getting stuff out, it's sort of a fuck you to everything, and then now it's like, oh, now you have to, now you have a business manager, and now you have to worry about tour buses, and you have to worry about personal politics, and where are the roadies, and where's this, and organizing this, and make sure we're here, and you know, it's like, I guess that alone would be enough to to knock someone over.
Well, it depends on how political you want to get, I think. You know, how much you want to bend. And I kind of look at it like, well, you know, like when we got together, I mean, the rebellious part of it and the fuck you and the don't trust anyone over 30 was a lot bigger deal in 1968 than it was, than it is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not any big deal to see somebody walk down the street with a guitar in their, you know, guitar case. Back then, it was almost like a symbol of saying, I mean, you were giving the rest of the world the finger. You know what I mean? Rock and roll was such a we talk about it being the soundtrack of our lives. You know, we get whatever song it was that in certain times of our, you know, our first kiss, the first whatever, important things in your life and, you know, whatever song it is. But back in the 60s, in the 70s, it was pretty heavy. I mean, what was going on, the whole social thing was just, I mean, it was rebellion. I mean, it started in the, you know, with all the assassinations and then all the anti-segregation marches and the Vietnam War. I mean, it was a lot heavier. I mean, it was a lot more life and death. I mean, it was critical. I mean, if you didn't go to college and you lost your deferment after you got out of high school, if you had a low number, there was a good chance you were going to get drafted and go to Vietnam and have to go to war. And we knew, you know, some of our friends that, you know, I had friends that never came back, you know, and the ones that did never came back and they never, I mean, came back and they weren't the same. You know, I mean, it's not like it is now. I mean, certainly we have the wars that you know, that are fought in some of these places where we don't know exactly what's going on. We don't might agree with the politics, but, you know, these guys go over and they give it up, you know, and my hat's off to them, you know. But I'll tell you, back then, it was really tough. And picking up a guitar and going out there and trying to make music, that music was part of the whole scene. I mean, you'd have Abbie Hoffman up there between Jimi Hendrix and Joan Baez, and he'd be up there like screaming about rebellion and changing society, and it was a really different time, you know. And I think that, as far as the book goes, I think the one thing that I wished I had put a little more emphasis on was that part of that era, and that's the big difference between then and now. I think as far as choosing music or choosing rock and roll to, you know, put a band together and going that way, it's a really tough business, but you know, at least you know that if you're good, if you have a shot, you know, I mean, there's you can have a career, you know. But back then it was a lot more iffy, you know. So it was definitely a more interesting time, and I just want to—I should have put a little bit more of that in there, just because of the backdrop. Because it just wasn't us that was like partying and doing all that stuff. I mean, it was pretty much that for young kids and college kids. I mean, the partying was, I think, a bit more intense than it is now.
Oh, you, really?
You know, I have to say, I mean, when people, you know, the government was, I mean, throwing people in jail for life for pot. Come on, we've really come a long way.
I mean, there are
people in jail now for pot, you know, that from then. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know. So it was a different time, man, you know.
But if so much of it came out of this sort of socio-political rebellion and these statements in the 60s, then in the 70s, did it sort of devolve into, you know, just glam times and, you know, just what partying and all that? Like, what was it? What did it feel like to be in a rock band in the 70s? Was that, how was that a unique experience?
Well, all I had to do was wave a bottle of Jack Daniels on stage, and it would be an instant roar from the crowd. So it was part of the thing, man. I mean, it was all part of the scene, you know. And it was you know, like Studio 54 and these guys, you know, the music was a big party scene. It was kind of the fallout from the 60s. The government was saying, look, you know, pot is bad for you. You know, you won't be able to get a hard on if you smoke pot. You'll never have kids if you take LSD. And we all knew that was bullshit. So it was probably the biggest disservice they could do, because your tendency is to go, well, if they say that about this, well, then everything else they say has got to be bullshit.
Right.
So why not try heroin? You know what I mean? And so it was. There was that whole thing about, you know, like not trusting what the government said, and having to learn the hard way for a lot of things. And I think that's what the 70s was about, was figuring it out. I mean, there's the hippies were they had their like. This new way we're going to live, and the communes and all that stuff, and the guys, some of the people I know that went off to the boondocks to live in a commune, they're like the selectmen now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the doctors, they're the you know, and they've got, you know, their hair's a little longer, you know, than you would think. I mean, it doesn't look out of place, you know what I mean? They're still wearing ties, but, you know, they realized that there were a lot of things, a lot of holes in there, in that philosophy, and they had to, you know, go on to make a living. And but boy, it was a wild time, you know.
Were there some, like, at that time, did you sort of manage, like, oh, this type of substance will produce this kind of show, or don't do this before you go on stage because it's hard to play, or was it just sort of like, hey, whatever?
Well, you kind of eased into it, you know what I mean? Because, at the beginning, it was like you might have a couple beers before you go on, you might not. It wasn't critical. And then as time went on, a couple of beers didn't do it. Then it got a little heavier, and it was... then you'd realize, you know, for myself, I mean, I realized that I, you know, there was a kind of a line I couldn't cross, or else I wouldn't be able to put on as good a show as possible. And I think near the end of my time in the 70s with Aerosmith is when I crossed that line a few times, and I knew that we weren't putting on the shows that we could have, you know, and I don't think that, I think it affected our ability to write the, you know, as good as songs as we were able to, and there were a lot of things that came with it by crossing that line, and we weren't able to reconcile some of the personal stuff with the normal tension that comes with a band. I mean, you got five different guys with five different ideas about how to play this song and how to entertain the audience, and you know, you got to have that because that's what gives it the energy. You know, it's the five people equals about 15. You know, when you're in a rock band, because that's what it's about. I mean, it's that magic of like having two or three like really strong talented people supported by some other guys that are just as talented and making music and entertaining a crowd, and that still holds the band together now. I mean, no matter what goes on between me and the singer.
Is it Scott or Steve? Steve, right?
You know, no matter. I mean, he's still like way deep down. We have a relationship that has nothing to do with music. You know, I mean, he's like a brother I never had, and you know, I mean, we have our ups and downs on that end. But when it comes to the music, we get in the studio and we'll butt heads. But that's what gives it the energy. You know, I mean, and I wouldn't want that to change. You know what I mean? If we agreed over everything, it would be pretty boring, you know?
Are you a good problem solver? Like, when you do... Because sometimes, especially when it comes to, you know, like, if you're really dead set on, it must be creatively expressed this way, this thing we're making, and the other person goes, no, it's got to be this way. Are you a compromiser, or do you just go, hey, fuck you, and then let's not do this at all, unless we're doing it my... Like, how do you...
It depends on what it's about. You know, it depends on what you're arguing about. And sometimes you got to you fight the big battles, and the other ones you might compromise a little bit. You know what I mean? Because you know, it may not, he may not be wrong. You know what I mean? And I might be off base. You know, so you know, I'm always willing to listen. You know, and it works the other way. So. It's really about what, you know, what it is we're talking about. You know, I mean, whether it's lyrics or you know, or the kind of song you want to put on it, put on the record, how many ballads you want to put on the record, you know, and then, you know, there's so you got to have some compromise in there, or else you end up with out of band.
Was there a specific example of something where you guys sort of came together and then it turned out, oh, actually, yeah, this compromise was much better than our individual ideas, and then that yielded this hit song?
Well, yeah. Well, a really easy one would be Dream On. I mean, he played that song a lot. I mean, when the band was getting together, and he had it from he had the basic idea on the piano from before he was in our Aerosmith, and I just felt like ballads. I mean, the whole thing is about energy. Rock and roll to me is about energy and just letting it fly, and by working the guitars into it and making it more of a have like a rock feel to it. Even though it still retains some of the musically some of the sensitivity around the lyrics, that was an example of a compromise that turned it into a song. So it sounded like Aerosmith, but it was still a ballad. Mm-hmm. And it by playing it live, it developed into a real showstopper, and it changed my mind about ballads over the years and how powerful they could be in a live arena, you know, rhetorically and physically.
But also, like, in the body of a whole rock show, it is kind of nice to have bam, 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 and then a little bit of a break from the tension. You know, something emotional, right. And then like back up in, then you can pick it back up with something else energetic after that.
Right. And you know, that's something, that's another thing you learn as far as dynamics, because it's almost like having a set, you know, writing up a set is almost like writing a song, because you want to have some dynamics in it, so you have a place to go, you know, mm-hmm. and then it comes back, and then after, you know, it may mellow out for a minute, and then it comes back with a bang. And so it's almost the same thing when you write a set list. You start off with some high energy, and then you kind of bring it back a little bit, and then get kind of a medium place and play some things that people, you know, that they're going to like, and maybe even sit down and listen to, and then you come back and with everything you got. So it's about dynamics, and that's something you figure out as you go out there. It isn't about just going out there and hitting people over the heads, you know, and playing as loud as you can for 20 minutes, you know.
What did you – do you talk in the book about why you took a break and then coming back and all? Do you talk about stuff?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I talk. And that's something – again, that's something that really – hasn't been out there much, you know, what I did during that time, because I was like, I mean, I just wanted to get out and play. I didn't want to have any of the big stuff, all that stuff you were talking about, like the managers, all that list of bullshit that we have to run, you know, kind of deal with to keep the machine running. You know, I didn't want to have to deal with that, and you know, I just wanted to get on stage with some other guys that wanted to have a good time and play rock and roll, and that's what we did. I did that for the better part of like 4 years, and then there were some personal things that finally were I reconciled and I met my wife. My wife that we're still together and going on 30 years. And,
wow.
You know, it just was I wanted to change it up a little bit. And by then, a lot of I realized a lot of the stuff that we were, that caused the band, or caused at least, made it untenable for me to stay in Aerosmith. A lot of that stuff had changed. A lot of it, I realized, was a bunch of bullshit. And you know, and I think we all kind of came to that conclusion. So after the dust settled, and we all started talking about possibly coming back together, that's what happened. And that's, I get into that in the book. And because a lot of things have been talked about, and a lot of stuff gets misconstrued in the press, and I just wanted to get it down on paper, because you know what? In two generations, my grandkids' grandkids are going to wonder who that guy was that had long hair and, you know, made this kind of music. Who knows what they're going to be listening to? And it's documented now.
Well, what's the most common misconception? Like, what is it that you hear in the press where you go, that's not, God damn it. Like, what do you...
Well, they're just, it, sometimes, well, there's a lot of little things. But probably one of the things that was never really talked about was how after the band got together and we got sober, and the manager that helped us at the beginning, actually he was my manager before the band got back together, and he really, really helped. He was like almost like a he really supported us in changing the way we did business and cleaned up. And And you know, it's obvious. I mean, Permanent Vacation was the first record we did when we were clean, and it was over the top, and that was just the start of it, and it was great. But then, as usual, things started to go south working with the guy, and near the end, we had to get rid of him. I mean, it just didn't work out. And none of that stuff was ever talked about. People didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. And I thought that and that plays into a lot of the other things that that we, again, you brought up about, you know, how do you with all the other stuff that goes with it, you know, how do you balance it and reconcile it and still try and hold on to some of that rebellion and some of that rock and roll spirit. And I try to kind of analyze some of that and explain it and in the book, how we managed to do that and hold on to some of our you know, that real gut rock and roll thing and still be commercial. You know, sometimes you get into battles with the businessmen and dealing with that. But it's really about deciding, you know, I mean, the music business changed. And the audience, their tastes in music kind of shifted a little bit, you know. And but we were able to I think, keep our I mean, I feel pretty good about 80% of the stuff we did overall. There are a couple of things in there that I know that we shouldn't have done. And
what do you think you shouldn't have
just
done?
I guess shouldn't have done isn't the right way to put it, but I think that the album Done with Mirrors. I know a lot of hardcore fans will argue with me about it, but I don't think it was up to the standard that we could have come out with. But if we hadn't have done that record, we never would have gotten to Permanent Vacation.
Right.
And so we had to go through that, and we kind of wrote that record and recorded it the way we used to, like, say, in the late 70s, which was... we had to alter our consciousness quite a bit to get going in the studio, and so the record turned out that way. And but like I said, it had to. It felt to me like the record was kind of unfinished, you know. And fortunately, you know, Geffen, the record company we were on, you know, had faith in us, and we were willing to try some changes, and Permanent Vacation came out of it.
Did you get sober as a group? Like, together you guys all got sober? Or you just individually got sober and then came back together?
Well, we were together. We were working as a band, and we actually toured without even having a new record out, just based on... I mean, we really wanted to see how it would work, you know, just playing together. I mean, we were still trying to control it, you know, the party thing. And it took an awful lot of energy trying to do that. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, only drinking on weekends for us just doesn't work. Yeah, we went out and we found that the fans were still out there, and we were able to tour without the record. At least it gave the record companies faith in us again, because we couldn't even get a record deal at that point. And so we went out, toured, basically did the whole tour without any trip ups, and Geffen signed us. So and the first record, did, you know, Done with Mirrors, didn't do what we wanted it to do, and but we found that we could live with each other and tour but we knew we had to make some changes, which we did with the help of that manager, and on to the next, which was Permanent Vacation.
Well, it's hard to dispel that myth too, that you know, especially if when you're younger, you're like, oh, maybe I have to be fucked up in order to be creative or in order to do this, and it's, you know, I know, you know, when I quit drinking, I was really worried, like, oh, maybe I won't be as funny, or I won't be as this. Maybe that was the thing. And it is, you do go out on a limb a little bit, but then you realize, like, oh, No. I actually need more focus now. Like, I was not focused before. Like, now it's actually better because I can think and plan and...
Well, you got the one thing that got me, you know, the light bulb that went off in my head was, hey, when I first heard rock and roll, I wasn't fucked up. You know, when I got the goosebumps when I heard the first, saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or went to the first rock show that I went to, I wasn't fucked up. I was totally sober and I was totally entranced. So that was it. That's all it took was, to have that realization and bang. And then I realized, you know, then we had to deal with the fact that, you know, we're America's party band. I mean, I always considered us like everybody, you know, America's hometown band, mm-hmm. garage band, you know, and part of that was the partying. And we were afraid that, you know, well, we're going to lose fans. People won't think, we have the stuff anymore. And it came down to like, well, look, either we're going to give them, you know, the best music we can give them sober, or they can watch us die, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, we can be making music from 6 feet under, and that don't happen. And
right.
So but the music pulled us through, and the fans were there to support us, and it was all about the music, and it helped us get through it, and we were able to put on better shows. And just like you said, you know, you kind of you clearer, you that talent that you have is able to come through. It because basically that shit, you know, after a while, I mean, it may work a little bit in the beginning, but it, you know, after a while, man, it's like, it really is. It's like shoveling dirt on your talent.
It's a bad long-term plan.
Yeah.
It's a very bad long-term plan for any kind of sustained success. But I think the first time I really, really understood who you guys were, I was sort of the right age. But it was the Run DMC collaboration. Because I was like high school age. MTV was just like in the sweet spot of MTV. And they played the fuck out of that video.
Right.
And of course, you know, and at first I was like, oh, who's this band? That they, and then realized, like, oh, you guys had a whole history. And it went, and like that... Oh, that was Oh, that song was Aerosmith, and I connected all these dots.
Right. Well, I'll tell you that it fascinated me that some people thought that was one of our first records. I had no idea. I had no idea that we were, you know, a band, you know, that did what we did in the '70s, and it was really amazing. I mean, and we were cruising along. I mean, we like I said, we had. We were on Geffen, and we were I think Permanent Vacation was out by then, and so we were going along fine, and we did this the Run DMC thing, which was totally amazing, and it had a big impact here, but you know, we really don't pay much attention to the charts and all that. I mean, we're really concerned about the live show, but when we went to Europe. And they were, and that's when we really got the impact. And it was like, you know, a lot of people really thought that it was the first record, the first thing. And it was like, you know, because we weren't huge over in Europe at that point. You know, we had only played over there twice, I think.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, we were kind of like in the theater kind of level, mm-hmm. at that point. And, you know, and we would play some festivals, but we really weren't as big there as we are now, because we've gone back, you know, many, many times since then and you know, built up our following there. But, yeah, when we hit Europe and we found out what an impact it made there, that's when it really struck us, you know. But we were really proud of the fact that we were part of that of the getting that video played on MTV, because I think it was one of the first, if not the first, video that that had black artists on playing hip hop, you know, and it was a major thing, you know, because MTV was really just starting and trying to figure out, you know, what their audience was and how to, you know, how to what videos to put on and that kind of thing. And anyway, it was great to be part of that.
When you played Walk This Way, would you play the original version? Did people want to be like, no, do the do-choo-choo-choo-choo? Like, did they want the record scratchy?
Nah, there was not at all. I never got any like vibe that, you know, it wasn't like the Run DMC version. And there's been, I don't know, count on two hands the times when the guys have come out and played with us, you know, played the song and we've done it, you know, and jammed. And I remember one time we played at one of their shows. Steven and I went in and you know, played and sat in with them on the song. So you know, it was really good. It was a really good thing all down the line. We made some new friends and some really, really talented people. Got a chance to work with Rick Rubin, and it was all great.
That's pretty amazing that, because obviously you hit a zone in the 70s, and then there was a dip, and then in the mid-80s, you hit another zone. Like, people don't always get a couple of zones, you know, like it's pretty remarkable. That did you recognize that the second time and go, okay, now guys, let's not fuck this up?
Yeah, that's why I think we put up with that manager as long as we did, you know. And my wife was very intuitive, and you know, she said, how come you're letting this guy, you know, basically push you around? Because, you know, I was an arrogant, fucking stubborn motherfucker when it came down to business things and you know, what the band stood for and all that. And, and you know, he was throwing things in there, and he started, like, getting into our private lives, and it was like, it was bullshit. And, but I sat there and she didn't know anything about Aerosmith before, you know, when we met. I mean, it wasn't like I walked around with Aerosmith t-shirts on, you know, or had a big A on my forehead, you know. I had my own band, and she didn't even know that it was my band. It was kind of like, she thought it was like the Jay Giles band with the guitar player. It was basically his band, but they had, you know, Peter Wolf was the front man.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, even though the name of the band was Jay Giles, you know, it was really everybody like focused on Peter, you know. And she knew Peter, and she knew those guys in the Boston scene, and she kind of had traveled around, you know, going to college in some different places, and so she kind of missed Aerosmith in the, you know, she's probably closer to your age, and so it just kind of missed in the you know, so she really didn't know what an Aerosmith was, you know. It wasn't the kind of music she listened to. She was more into alternative music and college music and that kind of thing. And so when I hired her for a video that I was doing for the project, and that's when we met, and she just thought, wow, that guy's pretty good on guitar. I mean, you know, if he gets noticed, he might have a career, you know. And that was pretty much it. And she didn't know any of the songs, you know, any of the Aerosmith, any of, you know, like Walk This Way or any of those 70s stuff. And so she didn't know, you know, like what we had lost, you know, and what we had, you know, had we were starting to get back. And, you know, the whole weird paradigm that you know, the band was kind of forming and figuring out, because we were just learning how to keep it together, mm-hmm. you know, sober, you know, working with different people, you know, working with producers that that we hadn't worked with before. And the music business had changed, like you said. I mean, MTV was the golden years. I mean, all that stuff. And I was like, you know, being as pragmatic as I am, I was going, well, do we really want to, you know, like fight with this guy and upset the balance that we have? You know, I mean, Steven and I are getting along okay. The band's getting along okay. Every time we put out a record, it does better than the last one. I mean, am I going to, like, do I really want to, like, take a chance and fuck it up? You mm-hmm. know what I mean? So I had to kind of explain that to her because she didn't know what we had before until she was like looking through some old boxes and saw some of the magazines, like old Cream magazines. or what was some of the other rock scene and some of the old, you know, the old rock mags that we were on. And then she came across a little plaque that we got from Madison Square Garden that said something like over 100,000 tickets sold at, you know, in 25 shows or whatever. You know, Madison Square Garden 25 times. You know, I mean, that was like, I mean, if you never knew that before, that's quite a little trophy to have.
Yeah.
You know, and then she realized, you know, just how big it was. And then she started to do a little bit more homework. And this was before the internet and stuff. Right. And she started to find out how big the band was back then. And because, like I said, I didn't go around broadcasting it, you know.
Right.
Though one time there was a song playing on the radio. And I said, that's the band I was in. And she said, no, it's not, you know. And I was like basically at the bottom. I mean, I had just gone through a really, really rough divorce. And the first time I took her out to dinner, my credit card came back in two pieces.
Oh, no.
It was one of those. So she got me at a time when, which I bless, you know, I was just blessed because she didn't, you know, I didn't meet her after coming off stage in front of 50,000 people. You know what I mean? She just saw me playing in a band in clubs and in a van. And like I said, you know, she just thought that I might have some potential. Somebody saw me, you know. So it wasn't like I was like, you know, all the I didn't have to worry about, you know, well, she's after me for my money or the glamour or the rock starness, all that shit, you know.
But it's not, is it, when all that was, you know, before this relationship, like in the 70s, like was it really easy? Is it really easy to date if you're in a big band, or is it sort of like, well, I mean, you can kind of hook up with people, but then you don't know who to trust, and it's weird, and people get weird. Is it not as easy as I think people would assume that it is?
Well, no, because you kind of can. I mean, literally, there's a short skirt room backstage after the show, and. You know, and I, you know what, I never went back there. I never, because I'm just not, I was never into that whole groupie thing or, you know, going down to the bar after the show and hanging out and hooking up, that kind of thing. And, you know, that's pretty much how, you know, bands do it and, you know, that are into that, you know, especially the English guys, because, you know, back then, again, the communication isn't the same. I mean, there's no Skyping. There's no, you know, there's no, like, I mean, they looked at it like we're in America and no one's going to find out what I'm doing here. And they would have, you know, wives and kids and they would be fucking everything that walked.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And, you know, I mean, in general, you know, I have to say, but, you know, I mean, there were certainly exceptions, but the point is it's, if you were looking for the right girl that you wanted to have a relationship with, I would say it would be really, really hard, you know? I mean, because you don't know. You just got to use your instincts and your best judgment, you know? But that's the same, I think, for any profession with this, you know, like a high visibility, a lot of money, some, you know, a lot of glamour, you know, nice vacations, nice cars, all that. Whether you're a doctor, a sports guy, I mean, you read about it all the time. I mean, you know, so it's not just a rock and roll thing. It's just that being an entertainer, it's more visible. It's like, you know, you end up in the gossip columns more and all that stuff. But, you know, once in a while you read about some doctor that hooked up with the nurse and the nurse fucking ratted him out, and, you know, and all that stuff. So, you know, it's not, I don't know, endemic. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but it's not like something that just rock and rollers have to deal with. But it is a tough thing, you know. I'm just really glad that I'm really lucky that I was in the place I was at. I mean, at that time when we met.
Well, that it's interesting to say that you were that what could have been construed as a low point. You know, I mean, yeah. I assume the divorce and stuff was some of the personal stuff that you were talking about that. And your credit card gets declined, and then it's nice you can go, I was very lucky that I was in this place so that I could, you know, because otherwise it might not have worked out with this person.
I mean, it definitely paid my dues.
How was she when everything started blowing up again? Like, was she like, oh, this is weird?
Well, I think that she was, you know, obviously happy about it because we both wanted a family. She wanted a family. I mean, we'd both been married before and had kids from previous marriages, and we weren't, you know, we both learned a lot from that. We knew we weren't going to make the same mistakes. And we hung out together off and on for 6 months before we even went out to dinner together, maybe a couple of dates, but that was it. And we played it really slow and easy, but you know, it was she was like a little, you know, almost every step was another kind of like shock, you know what I mean? You know, when things would happen like that, and you know, something big would happen. And but, you know, like when I said, you know, when this guy started going south, this manager, and, you know, when we knew we had to get rid of him, and that was probably the toughest part, because trying to explain to her, you know, what we had before and how heavy it was, and you know, what the good side of it was, and I didn't want to take a chance on screwing it up.
Yeah. So is everything good now? I mean, obviously you have the book. Which, by the way, is called Rocks, My Life In and Out of Aerosmith by Joe Perry. And then Joe Perry's Merry Christmas. Are things, you like, in general, good now? Are you talking to the singer? What's happening?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we have our ups and downs. But, man, you know, he's like the brother I never had, you know. And, you know, we have sometimes we won't talk to each other for a month, and then there's other times we'll talk to each other every day, you know, depending on what's going on. We like to scuba dive. So he's got a place in Maui sometimes, and we play Maui in Hawaii a lot, you know, when we're on the road. And so we'll get a chance, we'll go diving. And so there are other things, you know, where we get along. And it's complicated, you know, no doubt about it, you know. Yeah, everything's good, and everybody's doing well. And, you know, we're talking about touring next year, and I'm not sure when we'll go in the studio again, but I know we plan on touring next year, so.
How do you keep a song fresh on stage when you've played it 10,000 times? Like, when you're like, okay, let's do walk this way. Like, are you excited each time, or is there a place you go to sort of make it fresh again?
The audience does that. It's easy. I mean, when I play the first line to walk this way, the audience is on their feet, and it's like I get this adrenaline rush. I'm already like, you know, stoned on adrenaline.
Oh, that's good.
You know,
okay.
from the show. You know, there's that 5 minutes before the show. Stephen and I are like, you know, standing side by side, and we can feel that charge coming in. You know, that natural that vibe. You know, we hear the audience, you know, kind of, you know, getting up and getting ready, and then you know, when we play all these songs that we've played a ton of times, you play those. You know, we're playing them for the first time for a lot of people. And you know, it's just something that we learned. One of the first things we learned when the generation changed, you know, because there was an era, and there is with almost every artist when they start, when their audience basically is the same age as they are, mm-hmm. you know, and then there's the if you're lucky enough to keep it together and you have everything else, and you know, there's that shift, and then like all of a sudden the kind of music you're playing may not be the most popular thing that's going on right at that minute, you know, and there's another generation of kids that are younger that want their first band, you know, and then. So, like, you're dealing with, but then some of those kids want to see what this band was, you know. So that's when the audience starts to spread out demographically. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the 70s when punk came out and then disco came out, and that was like when it changed from we were like literally the same age as the kids in the audience, and then it was like. We you know, a couple of years older, and the punks were younger, and disco was like, you know, the thing, and you know, well, do we have to start playing disco music? You know what I mean? No, I don't think so. You know, I mean, actually, the Stones got away with it. They did a pretty good. They had a couple of records that were, you know, that I used to hear in the discos still sounded like the Stones, so yeah. They managed to pull it off, but it's not that far from rock and roll, you know. You know, that was the first shift, and that's when we realized that, you know, we got to stick to our guns and do what we do best, and not, you know, we're not going to like change and all of a sudden. If there's the latest thing is you know, Alanis Morissette, what are we going to do with that? She's the biggest thing on the planet right now. How are we going to adapt to that? Well, you don't. You stick to you play your music and you play it for your fans and write the best songs you can that you've, you know, been working on for years and keep going.
Except for hip hop. You did manage to squeeze into hip hop a little bit.
Well, again, I think, you know, hip hop is like very close to the blues to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I really identified the chain of music, you know, from the, you hear those songs from the 30s and the 40s and the guys like just banging on the guitars. You could just see them on the street corner, you know, like 25 years old, trying to enter, you know, fill the hat, you know, and they're singing about their lives. And what's the difference between that and the guys on the, you know, on the corner with the boom boxes, just, you know, just with the basic music and singing about and rapping about life on the street.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference, you know? And it's the same kind of the beat. I mean, it's catchy. I mean, it's what makes you want to move. And I just saw it as just another link in the chain, just like we've done. We're just taking what we learned before, added a little bit to it, and there's a whole batch of bands that learn from us. And, you know, and if they're really smart about it, they'll go back and learn what we learned, you know, and listen to the music from way back when, like we did.
So as we're kind of wrapping up, long-term plans? How, like, what do you see? Like, what do you want to do? Do you have, like, a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year plan? Or are you just sort of like, yeah, we'll just sort of take stuff as it comes and figure it out that way?
Well, I don't think we've ever looked farther ahead than 6 months or 10 to a year. I mean, ever. I mean, I remember having the calendar in the apartment, and, you know, it was like, if we could keep the calendar, like, so at least the weekends had gigs on, you know what I mean? We were happy. And it's that attitude has probably been the way we've always carried it, you know? And, but like I said, like, the managers, you know, like, I'm sure they have more of a long-term kind of thing, and we'll probably have a meeting in the next couple of months and talk about some options, like when we want to go back on the road, where we want to play, that kind of thing, and see where the riots are. You know what I mean? We were supposed to play in Kiev this year. We had to blow it off because of the riots and the upheaval there. And so, you know, the world is changing all the time, and we'll keep our eye on that. But mainly, we're a touring band, so we're going to be back out, and I expect that it'll be sometime next summer, but we'll see when we get together and talk about it.
That's cool, yeah. And ultimately, in the very first question that I asked you, I think one of the first questions, like, how do you keep a band together? It sounds like for you guys, it doesn't matter what the sort of ups and the downs are, and the when we're really popular, when we're less popular. When it's just, you keep going back to this idea of, like, we just like to play. And as long as you just like to make the thing, then all that other stuff is just sort of, you know, that's just the landscape passing by really fast, you know, while you're kind of on that on that trip.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, it seems like every year there are more fans out there, whether they're to our music or you know, whoever's hip, you know, it doesn't matter. They're just more fans. And in a lot of ways, it's really good, because bands that really talented bands that, like, say 10% of the audience of the music fans, say 10% of them would like that artist, you know. Say 30 years ago, that 10% might have been 100,000, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how, it's tough to have a career with you know, like that. And then, but now that 10% is maybe a million, you know what I mean, or 500,000. So in a lot of ways, there's room for more different kinds of music, you know, to work. And but then on the other hand, you know, you can't, I mean, the records, I think this is the first year where there hasn't been a record that sold over 100,000.
Right.
Which is really fucking weird.
That's weird. Fucking
really weird. It's because it used to be a big source of income, and it helped it so you could get on the road. And because, you know, you do a record, it helps get fans to come to see you play, and then the fans come to see you play, and then they might go out and buy your record. So we're, you know, it's kind of a circle that helps. But when the way that the fans get their music now, it's almost like, I mean, they're paying for it. Some of them are,
right?
it's not the kind of income that we used to, you know, what we used to see back in the golden age. And that's why I think we're at the end of an era right now. I mean, it's like things are really changing, you know, but it's the start of something new, and we'll see how it goes, because the fans still want to hear music, and there's great artists out there that want to play it. And in the middle, you got the music business, and somehow it'll adjust itself.
Right. Well, Joe, it was really nice chatting with you, and your book, again, rocks my life in and out of Aerosmith, and Joe Perry's Merry Christmas, which you should get really soon, because Christmas is, like, it's I can't even believe it's about a week away now?
It's really close, man.
Oh, shit.
So anyway, it's like, you know, there's a few standards on there. People will recognize it's. We just did it for the fun of it, and it's actually gotten a pretty good reception. And I hope that it's the start of a tradition. I want to try it next year. I'll probably do another two or three songs and add it to that. And I'd like to keep doing it every year. So we just got it started, and also it was a way to see how. The new distributing music differently.
Yeah.
It's the first time I've ever done something like this, which was like basically put it online, you know what I mean, and then advertise it, and that's it, you know. Actually, we only printed those up just for kind of just to give away, and as it turns out, we've selling out on the CDs, so hey.
Well, have a Merry Christmas.
Thanks.
When you actually do get to calm down and celebrate Christmas. And congratulations.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot for having me, man.
Yeah, good to see you.
Yeah.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone, as we end the podcast.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 65th National Finals of Distinguished Young Women.
Every year, one girl from every state leaves her family, her whole life behind, for 2 weeks and spends each day training, practicing, preparing. Because to win this competition, she needs to wow a panel of judges with her academic record, her athletic ability, her speaking skills, and a show-stopping talent.
I met her and I was like, she's gonna win.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
When I sing that song about being a black woman in America, there's gonna be backlash about that.
Oh, I'm just so happy, so happy.
I don't wanna see them, I don't wanna talk to them.
And then we stayed with them for the next year, unpacking just what happened those 2 weeks in Mobile. I'm Shimol Yai, and from Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.